Parshas Teruma, March 19th, Rabbi Mark Gottlieb, Senior Director of the Tikvah Fund, and member of RENAT, will be speaking.
First of all, thank you. Small crowd. Cold weather is really...
Small but sturdy.
Yeah, and if you don't know Rabbi Gottlieb, he's now Senior Director of the Tikvah Fund, as well as the member of RENAT, and the Yeshikai for accepting to give us a prayer.
Thank you so much, Rav Howie, Rav Doc. Thank you all for braving this bitter cold weather. We don't have a lot of time together tonight, but I hope in our time together that we look at one of these perennial problems or paradoxes in Jewish thought via Parshas Teruma. I think this will be a good footnote to Reb Yitz's Divrei Torah between Mincha and Ma'ariv the other day. So you'll chime in, Yitz, when the spirit moves you.
I'm quoted.
You're quoted. You're on the record right now. So a number of years ago, I heard Rabbi Jonathan Sacks at a conference, and he began his talk in a very provocative fashion. And I want to share it with you here tonight because it's totally apropos, totally relevant to Parshas Teruma. He said that sacred architecture is theology set in stone and wood. That sacred architecture is a philosophy, a worldview, a theology of, in this case, Judaism, that's actually built into the architecture, the surfaces, the stone and the wood. And he goes on to say that if you look at medieval Europe and you look at the great cathedrals like Notre Dame and Chartres in France, you get a certain image of the world. You learn about the grandeur of God and the insignificance of man. The contrast, the stark contrast between these Gothic edifices, these grand buildings, and man is meant to convey a theological truth. A theological truth that Christianity embodies, that there's a deep chasm, a dramatic gap between God and man. Whereas the Jewish shul conveys a totally different, almost antithetical theology, namely the proximity of God and the intimacy of man and God. Well, if that's true in the case of Mikdash Ma'at, in the sacred architecture of the synagogue, how much more true, Kal v'chomer, uben b'no shel Kal v'chomer, that this principle of sacred architecture being theology set in stone and wood is all the more true when it comes to the Mikdash Gadol, or the Mikdash Harbeh of the Mishkan, and the Mikdash itself, the base of Mikdash itself. So what I want to do tonight is to take a theological look at some of the elements in the Mishkan. And I want to do that by setting up a problem. And I want to set up this problem or paradox by invoking one of the most well-known theological or spiritual works of modern times. And that is Abraham Joshua Heschel's The Sabbath, its Meaning for Modern Man. This was a book that was published in 1951. It was a popular book in that it wasn't written for scholars. Heschel, of course, was a scholar, and he wrote his dissertation on a much more esoteric and arcane area in Torah Shebaal Peh, in Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. But this was a kind of breakaway hit, so to speak, in terms of popular literature. And it makes a very audacious claim. And I think many of you that have heard of this book or have even read this book know what the claim is. The claim is that Judaism, in contrast to other ancient civilizations, specifically the Greek world, had a much richer conception of the sanctity of time than the sanctity of space. That the Greeks had sacred islands, sacred temples, sacred spaces, and Judaism, and here it gets a little murky, Judaism celebrates the architecture of time over against the architecture of space. Kedushas Hazman over Kedushas Hamakom. Now, if we're honest, that claim, while very rhetorically powerful and very, you know, compelling from a polemical point of view, contrasting Judaism and Greek thought, is actually not all that true. Because witness this week's parsha. V'azuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham. You don't have to go to this week's parsha, but this is the point of this week's parsha. That sanctity of space is also a Jewish value. That yes, sanctity of time is perhaps the primordial or the first, the primary kedusha manifested in the world. Shabbos, in terms of Seder, Bereishis. But there's no question that there's a notion of kedushas hamakom, kedushas ha-cheftza. And you know, this is a fascinating question that gets, you know, struggled with and engaged throughout Parshanut, throughout Jewish thought, throughout Machshava. The Meshech Chachma very famously writes, and this was invoked by the great Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovitz, very iconoclastic figure, very sort of a gadfly in the Jewish thought, that what is that? That's, you know, he goes so far, and this is where he probably departs from, you know, Jewish tradition in the mainstay, like the Derech HaMelech, that this is like a form of paganism. Going to a stone, where's the Kedusha in that? And he actually quotes the Meshech Chachma, who is a very traditional rabbinic, Rav Meir Simcha Mitvinsk, the Or Sameach, big Talmud Chacham Mechaber, wrote on the Rambam, that Kedusha, by definition, never inheres in a Cheftza. That there's no such thing as intrinsic sanctity in this physical world. The only thing that is sacred in this world is obeying the will of God. And it has to be related to a sacred act or a sacred deed. Now how the Meshech Chachma stims this with this whole idea of Kedushas HaMakom, the Mishkan, the Mikdash, it's not totally clear, but this polemic that we only have Kedushas HaZman and not Kedushas HaMakom is clearly a simplistic overstatement. And now we have to come to the, you know, well, why are we inclined to adopt that distinction? Or why are we inclined to adopt that Heschelian notion that Kedushas HaZman is much more significant than Kedushas HaMakom? Anyone want to take a stab at that? Why would we want to do that? And remember, when is Heschel writing? It's very interesting. He's writing in 1951. So this is right after World War II, after Hakamas HaMedina. What might be a factor here? Yes, David.
Golus.
Meaning we don't have. In 51, we certainly didn't have Har HaBayis and, you know, the temple site, Temple Mount. So the reality of Golus.
But also, to amplify, the lack of the inability to call any place home for very long.
Okay, so a sort of existential reality of exile, of being refugees. Okay. Anything else? Anything else that what might Kedushas HaMakom, holiness of a place, what does that smack of that might rub against the intuitions of a modern man or woman? In other words, is there a political, and I don't mean political like Arab-Israeli conflict, although that's clearly, I think, you know, a factor as to how modern Jews today, even modern, you know, Orthodox Jews, how we're kind of conflicted about this idea of the Mikdash and the Mishkan. But more broadly, World War II, you know, the idea of any particular people, any particular regime, any particular nation, any particular soil, any particular blood having some elevated status, you know, almost holy status, is going to reek of the most awful, fascistic, nationalistic, racist connotations for a human being living in the wake of World War II and the Holocaust. So I think Heschel, you know, I don't want to psychologize here too much, but there's a clear relationship between this claim about Kedushas HaZman and the realities of political, you know, political, I would say, particularity. There's an expression in the history of Jewish-Christian polemics, the scandal of particularism, that the Jews say that the Jewish people, the flesh and blood of the Jewish people, are holy. Well, why? How is that fair? Is that just? Would a fair, loving God favor one of his children over another? Of course, that's at the heart of Judaism. The scandal of particularity is something we embrace. We, of course, have the other pole of the universal. But we don't deny the scandal of particularism. But in 1951, in the wake of Nazism and fascism, the scandal of particularism and this particular place, a holy site, a holy place, a holy people, a holy nation, a holy soil, might make people uncomfortable. It's a lot easier to say holy time. Kedushas Hazman, time is such an abstract concept. Where does time? Everybody has time. So I think this philosophical problem of Kedushas Hazman versus Kedushas HaMakom and the existence of a Mishkan, the very reality of a Mishkan, has a particularly modern modern dilemma or a modern conundrum that's associated with it. But the truth is, this problem that we've just laid out of the scandal of particularism, how can a particular space have inherent spiritual or holy or ontological qualities, this is an ancient question. This is not a question that Heschel was alone troubled by. This is a question that Shlomo HaMelech was troubled by. If you look in Melachim Aleph, Perek Ches, when Shlomo is completing the building of the Beis HaMikdash, it's an incredibly powerful couple of lines which he utters here. Ki ha'umnam yeshev Elokim ala aretz. Is it possible for God to dwell on the earth? Can he dwell in a building? Hinei ha'shamayim u'shamei ha'shamayim lo yichal kalucha. Af ki ha'bayit hazeh asher banisi. If the heavens and the heavens' heavens can't contain God, how could the house that I just built contain you? And then he says something so apropos of where we are. Ufanisa el tfilas abdecha ve'el tchinaso Hashem elokai lishmo el arina ve'el tfilah. Turn to my prayer. Help me understand this problem. Help me understand this ability for God to dwell in a particular space, in a particular location, more than any other place. Right? When we were kids, we know Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Well, that's true, but it's not true. It's more true for this place. This space, the Mishkan, is more the dwelling place of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So, how do we understand this? So I think one strategy that many Parshanim use to really attack this large theological or philosophical problem of how do you fit an infinite God in a finite space, and ultimately what is the purpose of Mishkan after all, is to construct different models of what the Mishkan is meant to signify. What is the Mishkan meant to symbolize? And that's one strategy that Parshanim utilize to help us address these problems, these philosophical or theological problems. So there are different typologies, which is just a fancy word for saying there are different models. There are different models that are associated with the Mishkan in Jewish thought that help us get a larger perspective on what the purpose and the ideal of the Mishkan really is. One of these is, and what I want to suggest is that each of these models teaches us something about the particular Parshan's vision of human perfection. That whatever model you're operating, whatever type you're employing to understand the Mishkan, its theological significance, is going to give you a window into what your ideal vision of humanity or what your ideal vision of human perfection is. And so you might be familiar with some of these models that are out there. What is the Mishkan compared to? Well, Yitz knows, because Yitz gave the Dvar Torah between Mincha and Maariv the other day. And one of the models is, of course, Har Sinai. But I want to start before Har Sinai. I want to suggest another model. What does the Mishkan attempt to recreate? In other words, the Mishkan is meant to recreate, in this trope, in this theme, the Mishkan is meant to recreate some ideal vision of man. So we have our choices in Jewish thought, in the history of the Jewish people. We have different models of what was an idyllic state of man and God. So one of them is Har Sinai. And we'll come back to that in a moment. What's earlier than Har Sinai that you think might be used as a kind of model for the Mishkan?
Gan Eden.
Gan Eden, excellent. So say a little bit more about what do you think, what would that mean if the Mishkan is patterned after Gan Eden?
It's a place where Hashem is and he knows of it.
Great. Can you give me any proofs? Can you give me any clues or hints that there is some relationship between the Mishkan and Gan Eden? Not because Mark Gottlieb is saying this, or you fine young man.
Moshe Golubchik.
Moshe Golubchik.
I haven't learned enough from Mark season.
Well, just think about
Kruvim.
The Kruvim. Excellent, right? The only two times in Torah where Kruvim are mentioned are in reference to the Gan Eden, when Adam Harishon is cast out of Gan Eden, and the Kruvim that are on top of the Aron Bris, Aron HaBris. You could have known that. I was hoping you'd pull it out, because... No, he's good. So, number one, the Kruvim. What else? These are a little bit tougher, but there's a real symbolism here. Yes? The Avanim, right? The different stones and the different minerals and the different geological evidence of Gan Eden links up with the Avnei Shoam and the Avnei Miluim of the Aaron HaKohen's Choshen. David?
Maybe not directly Gan Eden, but Korbanot.
Okay, well, we don't have Korbanot directly in Gan Eden.
Subsequently.
Why don't we? We did we?
Well, they both. What a carbon. I'm sorry. I'm up by a generation.
Right, you're up by a generation. They're outside of Gan Eden. They're not in Gan Eden there. Interesting. The phrase, what is Adam Arishon's duty in Gan Eden? Do you remember how the Torah describes, Rabbi Salvejik used it, pardon? La'avdir l'shamra. That you should till, you should work, you should protect, you should observe. Rav Soloveitchik uses La'avdil L'shamra in The Lonely Man of Faith as a kind of typology or dialectic in contrast to Pru Urvu Umi Lueta Arz V'Kiv Shua. This is a more conservatory note. La'avdil L'shamra. The Levim and the Kohanim in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, what did they do? Avoda and Shmira. So there are these clues that kind of give us some sense of a parallelism, and for the most part, this is not a traditional parshanut move. This was mostly pointed out by biblical scholars in terms of reading the text carefully. There are some allusions in Chazal and the Meforshim, but not many. And the trope here would be man's communion with God, as Mr. Golubchik offered us. One other thing that the Kadosh Baruch Hu was mishalech in the Gan, right? He somehow traveled in the Gan. His spirit hovered in the Gan. Mishalech is also a description for God's presence in the Mishkan. The Kvod Hashem was mishalech in the Mishkan. The idea that the Torah, the Aron HaBris, is connected to Eitz HaChaim. So there are lots of little clues. I don't think what I'm saying is very novel, but this typology of the Mishkan and Gan Eden is one version, which essentially says that you're in this pre-sin state, you're in this pre-fall state in communion with God. And that's the ideal state of human perfection, and the Mishkan somehow recreates this. Okay, that's typology one. Second model is Yitz's model, which is really the Ramban's model. But the Ramban suggests, very famously at the beginning of Parshas Truma, that the Mishkan is an attempt to recreate and perpetuate the Sinai experience. That whereas Yetzias Mitzrayim is commemorated in so many ways in our Avodas Hashem, from Pesach and the Haggadah and Dalet Kosos and Karban Pesach to mitzvahs like Bikurim, Tfilin, Shabbos, Shema. Yetzias Mitzrayim is continuously remembered and commemorated. When is Maimon Har Sinai commemorated or remembered? Shavuot? Well, does it actually tell us in the Torah what the date of you know, Maimon Har Sinai was? Chazal argue whether it was the 6th or the 7th. This is a famous big... the Abarbanel famously says that it has nothing to do with Maimon Har Sinai, that it's an agricultural holiday. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman in the early 20th, late 19th, early 20th century says no, that Shavuot and Matan Torah were always connected implicitly, even in the Torah, and certainly by the time of Chazal. But the Ramban is the great champion of this theory, that the Mikdash is not the commemoration of Maimon Har Sinai, but it's the perpetuation of the theophany at Sinai. And it's a very beautiful idea. You've got the Eish, you've got the Anan HaKavod, you've got the Kvod Hashem, you've got the Mizbeach, you've got a lot of elements in terms of the architecture, the phenomena of Maimon Har Sinai being replayed in the Mishkan. Okay, what would the ideal then be? What would this model, this typology of human perfection be? This relationship to God through the law, through the Torah, that God reveals His presence. God reveals His presence to man, but man has to achieve adherence and loyalty to the law, to the Torah, to the Luchot. Okay. This is the last model that I suggested, the Ramban, which Yitzhak described. This is a classical, you know, Parshanut move. I want to suggest a modern variation or a modern move on this model, on the model of the Mishkan, and what it means. And here, we have to spend a moment thinking about what is modern theology? Because I think modern theology points in a different direction, in a new direction, and it's relevant to everything that we do, to the Heschel moment that we discussed at the very beginning of the problem of space versus time, but in a more concrete way. I want to share a story with you that I think encapsulates this modern move in theology that begins to open up some new vistas. So, there was a Hasidic Rebbe in the 19th century by the name of Rav Yitzchak Rav Itzel Skver. Skver is one of the branches from Chernobyl. Skver, Rachmistrivka, Spinka, not Spinka. There are 6 or 7 Tolner that come from Rav Itzlis, that come from the Rav Nachum Mordechai in Chernobyl, and Rav Itzlis Fer was one of his descendants. He had a particular knack. He was known to be very effective in addressing the concerns of the masculine. That was his reputation. Each Rebbe had their own sort of expertise. That was his expertise, that he was able to address the skeptical challenges of the maskilim. One day, a maskil comes to him. It's going to sound like a setup for a joke, but it really isn't. It's just a setup for a good Hasidish vort that gives us a window into modern theology. So this maskil comes to Rav Itzela Skver and says, you know, Rav Itzela, I want to be a frum Jew. I really, truly want to be a frum Jew. But something's not working. And, you know, I wake up every morning and I do the right thing. I try to do the right thing. I wake up, I wash neglevasser. I do the, you know, the right thing, and I start davening. And because I'm a maskil, I take my prayers very seriously. I think about each word that I'm saying. And I start with Mode Ani. And I start Mode Ani Lefanecha Melech Haibakaya, that I thank or I acknowledge the king who lives and is everlasting. And when I get to the word Melech, all sorts of metaphysical questions creep in on me. What does it mean that God's a king? He's not really a melech of flesh and blood. So what is he? If he's a melech of power, then why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? I get so frustrated. I get so caught up in asking these metaphysical questions, these philosophical questions about the melech. I just can't go on with the rest of my davening. I can't go on with the rest of my day. Rebbe, what should I do? So Rabbi Yitzhak Sfer turns around, says, you know what, you and I, we're really not so different. I also try to be a frum Jew. I wake up every morning, I watch Negelwasser, and even though I'm not a maskil, I try to think about what I'm saying in davening. I try to think about every word. There's only one difference between me and you. We stop at a different word. Because when I get to the word mode ani, when I get to the word I, that's when I start to ask all the philosophical questions. What does it mean for a human being to be a human? What does it mean to be a human? Am I more like an angel? Am I more like an animal? I'm somewhere in between. I ask all my philosophical questions about man. I don't have time to ask questions about the melech. Now, this can be a cute little Hasidic story, but it contains a deep truth about the project of modern theology. Because for the medievals, for the Ramban, for the Rambam, for medieval philosophers and theologians, the focus was on God. What is the nature of God? What is the definition of God? What are God's attributes? Are they attributes of action? Are they attributes of existence? Are they essential attributes? Are they accidental attributes? What are they? What is God? The modern theologian doesn't start with God. He gets to God, but he starts with man. He says, and the Rav used to say this, that the Torah is not a human theology about God, but it's a divine anthropology about man. Those are big words, but what it means is something very simple. That Torah, that religious philosophy in the modern world, has to start with the human experience, has to start with the human being, has to start, it's a theological anthropology. That's not an oxymoron. It's a godly or divinely inspired or divinely perspectival perspective on human beings, on man. This is the project of modern theology. And I want to highlight one modern parshan that actually does this very work. If you look at the source sheet, take a look at the first source sheet. The Ramban. So what does the Ramban... This is not the Ramban at the beginning of Parshas Truma that we mentioned earlier. This is the Ramban at the beginning of Sefer Shmos. This is the Ramban's Hakdama to Sefer Shmos. Okay, so he says that Hishlim HaKasav Sefer Breishis, the Torah finishes out Sefer Breishis, Shehu Sefer HaYitzira, it's called the Book of Creation, the Book of Formation, the Chiddush HaOlam, in the creation of the world. The Yetzirah is called Nozar, and in the creation of the cosmos, of every living, of every created being, or every created thing. Uvemikrei ha'avos kulam shehen ki'ini Yetzirah Slozar. What does Sefer Bereishis basically talk about? What's the subject matter of Sefer Bereishis? It's the creation of the world, but also what? The bulk of Bereishis is about the Avos, about our parents, our physical, biological, and spiritual parents. And why are they Kain Yitziras? They're like the Yitzira of their children. They're the source of the creation of their children. Mineisha Kol Mikraim, all the actions and the circumstances of their children's lives. Siure Devarim Lirmoz Hodiya Kol Ha'adid Lagolahem. That we know the famous principle of Maisa Avos Simin Labanim, that the actions of the forefathers are signs or markers or ideals for the children. And that's what the Avos function. Right? Ba'achrei shehishlim ha'yitzira hitchil sefer acher b'inyan ha'maseh abav min ha'ramazimayim. And after the book of the Yitzira, then we can go to the second book where the actions and the existence of the people come into fruition. And now go down a few lines. B'hineh ha'golos. So that's how Shmos begins. We're in exile, right? But what this galus is not completed, is not concluded. That they have to go back to their original state of the Avos. They have to return to the state of their Avos. When they left Egypt, even though they left the house of bondage, they were still slaves. They were in a foreign land. They were confused and wandering in the desert. But also a Mishkan, see the Ramban, the Shitaso combines Har Sinai and the Mishkan. It wasn't like Rashi says, Ein Mukdam O Me'uchar, that it was because of the Chet HaEgel. It was ideally the Mishkan was meant to be built after the Matan Torah. B'Shava Kadosh Baruch Hu V'Hishri Shchinaso Beinayim, God's presence dwells in them. Uz Shavu El Ma'alas Avosam, then they return to the level of their parents. Shahaya Sod Eloka Ale Ahalehem. This is beautiful. That there's an esoteric or secret that there's God rests in their tents, in their dwellings. The Haim Haim Hamerkava. That the Avos themselves, this is a quote from the Medrash, that the Avos were the chariot of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Uz next to Vukubulim, when the Mishkan was built and completed, then we can say that the Jewish people are finally redeemed, because they return to the status of the Avos. They return to the state where HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwells within the Jewish people. Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu dir betachtonim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, according to the Zohar, wants a place amongst the human beings. That some divine secret or some divine essence requires HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be fully engaged in the human world. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to dwell amongst human beings. Who are the most pristine, the ideal human beings? The Avos. The return of the Shekhinah to man was through the Mishkan. First it was the Avos, and then it was the Mishkan. First, HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwelt in the homes of the Avos, and then he dwelt in the Mishkan. But the symbolism is that the Mishkan is a symbol of the home of the Avos. Normally, when we think about, when I was a kid, I was always told by Rabbi Bam, don't sit on the table, right? Don't sit on the table. Because what? The table is what? A Mizbeach. The table is a Mizbeach. Actually, it's the reverse. The Mizbeach is a mushal to the table of the Avos. It's not that the Mizbeach is the sign and the table is the signified or the symbol. It's the reverse. The symbolism goes in the opposite direction. That the Mishkan becomes the recreation of what Hashem had with the Avos in their day without a Mishkan, without mitzvos, without the law. They had it in the Avos time. How do you know this? Or how do you... The Shem Shmuel, who was the Sachat Shava Rebbe, who wrote in the early 20th century, his father was the Avnei Nezer, big Talmud Chacham, wrote the Eglei Tal and the Shabbos. His son, Rav Shmuel Borgstein, wrote a sefer called the Shem Shmuel. It's Hasidic homily, but there's more than homily here. There's theology here. Because the Shem Shmuel suggests, and with this we'll conclude, how do you know that there's a relationship between the home of the Avos and the Mishkan? Very famous Rashi. At the end of Parshas Chayisara, turn to the last page. What happens here? Remember, Yitzhak is waiting for Rivka. Eliezer comes back on this long mission to Aram Naharaim. And what happens? He sees Rivka. Rivka falls off the camel. And what? V'yivyeh pasuk samach zayin in Chayisara, Perek Chaf Dalet, pasuk samach zayin. V'yivyeh Yitzhak ohad la'sara. That Yitzhak brings Rivka into the Oel of Sarah, of the Oel of Sarah Imo. Look at Rashi. What do we know about this Oel of Sarah? What was famous about the Oel of Sarah? There were three significant simanim, features, miracles, supernatural events in the Oel of Sarah. When Sarah died, they went away. When Rivka came in, they were reestablished. What were the three? He says right here. Rashi says right here. Right, the Ner Doluk may Erev Shabbos Erev Shabbos. There was a light from Erev Shabbos to Erev Shabbos, never went out. Ubracha Metsuya Meisa, and there was bounty that was found in the bread. The food was plentiful. The Anan Kashur Ala Oel, and the Anan, there was a cloud that was over the Oel. What are these three things? It's the Mishkan, the Ner HaMa'aravi, the Ner that was always on in the menorah. The Pasa Metsuya Meisa is the Lechem Apanim of the Shulchan. There was material bounty, material sustenance, and the Anan Kashur Ala Oel was the Anan HaKavod, was on top of the Oel Moed, was on top of the Mishkan. That was the Mishkan. This is a modern But I said before that the modern theological project is an anthropology, a theological anthropology. This is an anthropology. You're saying that the home of Avram and Sarah, the home of the Avos, that was where the original Kedusha of the Shekhinah rested. The love of Avram and Sarah, the home life, the reality, the corporeality, the materiality, the life, the real hustle and bustle of everyday human life. That was where the Kedusha of the Shekhinah rested. The Mishkan is a, I don't want to say a pale recollection or image, but a image of the OL of Avram and Sarah. That is the reversal in the modern theological move that I think when you think about the models of human perfection, the home, the place of familial love, the place of humanity, the Tzelem Elohim, that's a model of human perfection for a modern theologian like Shemesh Shmuel, who was a Hasidic Rebbe, but he had a modern sensibility just like Rav Itzel of Skver. Thank you all very much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. This is not just drush. This is theology. There's a big difference.
So Rabbi, after the Churban, the Gemara says the Shekhinah, after the Shulchan is the Chafer. The Gemara says that.
Right.
So you go back to the
right to the Shulchan.
To the Shulchan.
Yeah. The Shulchan is Churban. Very
important. So
well, I think it's both. It's linked to it.